Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, a knife allegation, the possibility of death row. That's what Nick Reiner is facing after allegedly stabbing both of his parents to death in their Brentwood home. Rob Reiner, one of the most celebrated directors in American film history, and his wife, Michelle Singer Reiner, were found by their daughter. Their 32-year-old son was arrested hours later near USC. DA Nathan Huckman is calling this a case that demands justice, but building a first-degree murder case requires more than a grieving city and famous victims. It requires intent, premeditation, and evidence that holds up beyond a reasonable doubt. Former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis is here to walk us through how the DA's office approaches a case like this, starting from the moment the charges are filed. And we're going to take a look at this from both angles today, both from the prosecution and from the defense. We're going to start first exclusively talking about prosecution angles, and then we'll segue over to defense. Luckily, you got the prelice to do it, having been on both sides of a courtroom before. Let's start here, Eric. Nick Reiner was charged with two counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances of multiple murders. From a prosecution standpoint, what does special circumstances signal about how the DA's office is framing the case here from literally day one?
To me, Tony, it looks like they're teeing up for the possibility of the death penalty. Usually in death penalty litigation, you need these aggravating factors. You have to prove those at the penalty phase. You have to prove they outweigh the mitigating factors in order to try and get a sentence of death. And so it seems like they're telegraphing from the outset, hey, death penalty's on the table. We have at least these two aggravating factors we're asserting. Could be more as the investigation proceeds.
What makes them want to pursue the death penalty in a case like this? I don't mean to sound cold and callous, but there's lots of murders every day. What changes this situation?
Stacey, it's an important question because and historically, California is not like super jazzed about the death penalty. They don't bring it, you know, as often as Utah or some other state like that. I think that the public exposure, the national attention on the case could be playing a role. The fact that the alleged victims were very high profile folks contributed a lot to the community. It's a tremendous loss. Those things matter. And then on top of that, Hochman has just made the DA in California has just made some interesting calls in the Menendez brothers case, in this case, and other high profile cases. So a bit of a head scratcher on that.
Okay.
And Hochman said his office is going to be taking the thoughts and the desires of the family into consideration regarding the death penalty here on this, which that is something I was thinking about earlier today. Rob Reiner and his wife, I don't know, no one can speak for them, but I highly doubt, even even if they could speak after their own death, that they would be in favor of the death penalty for their own son. I don't see that. I see a lot of other people. I think society going, yeah, but at the end, I mean, he's the one who even said, I'd rather, have you, alive and basically, be living in misery than you dead somewhere. I'm paraphrasing that somewhat. But how do victim family dynamics typically influence that sort of decision, especially when the defendant is also a family member?
Sure. So most states have what's called like a Victims' Rights Act, where they actually have to consult in the case of a homicide and decedents, the next of kin. And so the next of kin in this case is going to be the Reiner's two other children who are really stand in the shoes and qualify as victims under the law. And so the DA is going to go to them and say, what do you think should happen in this case? What do you want the outcome to be? And typically prosecutors are supposed to give significant weight to the family's wishes and desires. I can't imagine that these remaining children would want death for their sibling. They might even consult family members outside of the nuclear family, but still, who's going to say, yeah, kill this guy on that side of things? I'm not sure anyone is.
They've had enough trauma in this family.
It would be very surprising, I think, if they were. But again, you can't speak. I mean, no one can speak for these families and these victims. I mean, the hell that those other siblings, I'm sure, have lived through in the shadow of their brother and the shadow of their parents, exhausting themselves of energy, of life, of resources, trying to save this one kid, and ultimately he takes their life. I still don't see them wanting that. You say, they're supposed to take that into consideration. Again, it's a fast and loose word when it comes to legalese. Supposed to doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean, yes, this amount of weight, X amount needs to be put on here. I doubt there's a worksheet involved. Maybe there is, but ultimately, at the end of the day, how often do we see that take place, where they do honor the wishes of a family member in a case like this, where death is on the table, versus the societal wish of what may be on the table?
You've touched on an important point, because that's supposed to, qualification is really kind of aspirational. It's kind of like, hey, DA, you should consider this. But there's no legal requirement that they give effect to the wishes of the remaining family members. And, I liken it to a domestic violence context. We see so many times where there is a living victim, like the spouse who was battered or allegedly, and the spouse says, hey, I don't want to prosecute, or I don't want want him to get prison time or jail or her. And the DA kind of just does what they want anyway. So it's sort of like a warm and fuzzy feel-good aspirational thing. But in practice, so many DAs deviate from what the family's wishes actually are.
It just kind of comes down to your DA, I'm guessing, and how well they like to process other people's opinions versus their own. Not the same sort of case. I mean, there's similar aspects. Parents are dead at the hands of their child, the Menendez brothers. Hochman is also the DA on that, and he's the one who helped keep them behind bars and really pushed for the previous DA wanting to let them out. He pushed, nah, ultimately the parole board made the decision there. But the family of the Menendez brothers, most of them were all gung-ho for them to be let out. This is an example of where you have family, different sort of scenario, being let out of prison. The family, they're saying it's time, let them out, and not listening to that sort of family opinion whatsoever.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I think it's a significant parallel, and it might even give us a glimpse into how Hochman treats these cases. You know, as a DA, you have a number of duties. You have a duty, in a sense, to the family, to the victims in the case. You have a duty, in a sense, to the public good and to protecting the public and the community. And sometimes those duties, those interests, can be in conflict with one another. And so, how do you decide? And furthermore, how do you go back to the family and say, "Hey, I know you guys want X, but I'm going to do Y." Sorry, especially in a death case. That's a delicate conversation.
Yeah, it really would be. The DA specifically added the allegation of personally using a deadly weapon. These are all the terms that are in here that sometimes we gloss over and we don't realize what it all means or the weight that it all holds. The deadly weapon being a knife, that's not automatic in a stabbing case. What does that tell you about how prosecutors plan to argue aggravating factors in this trial?
It seems like they are maybe kind of reaching a little bit to try and really bolster their case. Because like you alluded, in many cases, stabbing cases, that special circumstance is not added. It's not necessary. But when you're having the death penalty on the table, I really think that that's the message Hochman is sending by expressly identifying these alleged aggravating circumstances, including that there was a knife and a stabbing. We know there was a knife and a stab.
Yeah.
Wording is always important with the legal field, is it yeah. not? I mean, every word is precisely chosen for a reason.
Oh, sure. And you know, there's at least an argument that if the DA doesn't come forward with these aggravating circumstances in a prompt fashion and then a year down the road wants to seek the death penalty, you know, that could be problematic. And so it's, in a sense, preserving the government's ability to pursue the most serious consequence that can be imposed in a criminal yeah. case, which is death.
You got to cross the T's and dot the I's and not do that in reverse. Conan O'Brien's Christmas party, obviously that's a big factor in all of this, at least the story of what happened, him being at the party basically because mom and dad didn't want to leave Junior home alone. Their 32-year-old son, they brought him to keep an eye on him, basically. He shows up in a hoodie to a black tie affair and allegedly is confrontational to people, going around, according to some people that were at the party. The allegation is he's asking them what their name is and if they're a celebrity and staring at people, interrupting private conversations. Very, very bizarre behavior, eventually leading to Rob Reiner and his son Nick getting into a very public argument, allegedly at that party. How do you think this is going to play in terms of use by the prosecutor in this case? I mean, if at all, and how much weight would someone lean on to with this little factoid, this public outburst, this public confrontation, these issues, mere hours before the alleged murders actually took place from Nick?
Sure. So so the DA has got to consider how this escalated. What led to it? Were there any statements of intentionality or threats or frustration or whatever? Did that sort of culminate in some horrible event later? The DA has got to look at that. But it's going to be difficult to do that, Tony, when your witnesses might be Conan O'Brien and comedian Bill Hader. You know, as a prosecutor, I can get an investigator on the phone and call Joe Schmo, who saw a stabbing, and get information. I can't just call up Conan O'Brien. And so there are going to be some logistical impediments to the investigation in terms of acquiring the information they need from the individuals who might have it.
I would imagine all of them are probably going to be speaking through their own attorneys as well. Would that not be an accurate assumption? I mean, if you're a celebrity, you have the money, your attorney is pretty much on speed dial. It's one of your confidants. I don't know. I mean, is that going to be a factor? And not to say that anybody is not going to want to come forward with information, but we're talking very high profile people here in a very, you know, horrible, horrible situation here. Does that play a role in any way, shape, or form in terms of gathering statements and information from witnesses?
You know, I think it totally does, because on the prosecutorial side, you want the statement from the mouth of the person who made the personal observations. You want to have an exchange with them, have an open questioning, an open dialogue. If you get these folks' attorneys involved, you know, they might opt for just sending a written statement that has three, you know, quick sentences that said, you know, Conan O'Brien saw Nick there. Nick appeared upset at one point, and then he left. Well, as a prosecutor, you want to have an hours-long interview with this witness, but that might be difficult, as all these folks have lawyers, and to get it straight from that person is going to be hard. And then on the defense side, you say, hey, we don't know that this is actually what this witness saw or felt. This is just a letter from their attorney.
I have some questions here. We'll get to that when we go to the defense about the actual party itself. And I'm curious about some angles that maybe the defense will take, but we'll get to that in a moment. The DA emphasized the charges are not evidence, and the DA asked the public to wait for court proceedings. That's unusual restraint for a high-profile case. What does that tell you about how the office is kind of managing this prosecution? Is it, you know, with extra care because of who it is and the amount of attention here?
They've got to be super cautious. You know, we've seen in other high-profile prosecutions where the government comes out kind of guns a-blazing and vilifies the defendant. We've seen that in some of the what some folks might call political prosecutions. And then what happens on the defense side is they say, hey, my client can't get a fair trial because he's been cast as a villain in these press conferences that the whole nation watched. And so I think it's smart and ethical, in fact, for the district attorney to have a sense of caution in how they're discussing this case and ensuring that people don't jump to conclusions, wait till the evidence comes out. And I think that's really the right move and aligned with the role of the prosecutor as seeking justice as opposed to seeking convictions.
Nick Reiner was arrested without incident near USC just hours after the killings and reportedly checked into a Santa Monica hotel that same night. There's been various reports. TMZ had reported early on that there was allegedly blood found in that hotel room. It's the allegation. Consciousness of guilt is going to be a big thing in this, especially if we're talking about possible insanity or areas of that. Showing that this person knew what they were doing is likely going to be a key element to this case. When you can show that a person went and checked into a hotel, came out of the hotel, goes to the gas station, seems to be, you know, operating, you know, with some, you know, not in any sort of psychotic state necessarily. What sort of behavior does that suggest when this gets to trial? Does that lean more into, you know, this guy is with it? There is going to be a consciousness of guilt here. The fact that he's not going home that night, he's going to a hotel, that he is competent. How does it all play into the narrative?
As a DA, when you see a possible not guilty by reason of insanity defense coming up. You've got to look for facts that might undercut that. So exactly what you said, Tony, you want to look at, the actions that this person took, and they don't have to be smart decisions, but if you can identify that there's kind of a rational basis behind it, that he appears to be acting normal, that it appears to be just standard behavior for him and any other normal person, that sort of undercuts this likely claim on the back end from defense that he might have been insane. And so on top of that, talking about what happened at the party, was there an argument? Did this escalate? You know, it's common sense that if there is a dispute between two people and it gets heated and it leads to some violent event, well, that dispute likely contributed to that violent event. That is all a rational thought process that undermines some future claim of insanity.
But you've also got somebody who spent, 17 stints in rehab. I mean, he's showing the inability to recover from whatever illness he officially has. Doesn't that lead to him not being aware of what he's doing?
It certainly depends on who you ask. And if you ask defense, that's certainly a horse that they will likely ride. And you've got to look at from the prosecutorial standpoint, people have challenges, people have problems. And that doesn't mean they are immune from a legal responsibility for stabbing somebody up. But if it has crossed a line into insanity, then the prosecution might have a real problem.
Alan Jackson is Nick Reiner's defense attorney. Yes, that Alan Jackson from the Karen Reed case. He said very publicly there are, quote, very complex and serious issues in this case, and urged the public not to rush to judgment. That's defense attorney code for something. The question is what? Nick Reiner has a documented decades-long history of severe addiction. He's been in and out of rehab since age 15, at least 17 stints by the time he was 22. He's spoken openly about meth, heroin, homelessness, psychotic episodes while using. His own father directed that semi-autobiographical film about his struggle. And then just 10 days before the killings, a family friend described him as being on the upswing, looking healthy, in good spirits. So what happened? And how does defense attorney Eric Faddis believe the defense will try to reframe this? He's here with us to help break it all down. Is this going to be not necessarily, pitched as cold-blooded homicide? Obviously, the defense doesn't want it to look that way. That's what the prosecution's going to be looking at. But is it something else entirely? Defense attorney Alan Jackson, like we said, made that statement. Very complex and serious issues in this case. Based on what's publicly known, what defense strategies do you think are already being considered here by good old AJ?
Yeah, that statement, in addition to postponing the arraignment, not once, but twice, it's already been postponed twice, tells me a few things. Because typically at an arraignment, at least down the line, the defense is going to have to enter a plea. Is it going to be guilty? Is it going to be not guilty? Is it going to be not guilty by reason of insanity? Well, you don't want to enter that plea of not guilty by reason of insanity and then walk it back later. So you kind of have to have your ducks in a row. And my apprehension is that Alan Jackson is looking into that, probably having mental health experts analyze and evaluate his client, even in these very early stages, such that he's teeing up his potential defense. Could be not guilty by reason of insanity, could be some kind of psychotic break, could be an accident, could be some heat of passion sort of mitigator. I think there's a lot of avenues that they're likely exploring at this time.
Is the postponement of any of this theatrics? Is it, I mean, maybe it works hand in hand. Maybe it's a little bit of, you don't want to walk something back. So you might as well take some extra time if it's available to you. And it appears to be in the theatrics of, well, he's not well enough to make this arraignment here 2 days in a row. Now we're going to do it in January. And then it buys him some time for some of those evaluations. Is it more than theatrics, I guess, would be the word?
could be a combination of both. And what I mean is that the postponement of the arraignments, that could be for a number of reasons. It could be oftentimes, I'm not saying this would happen here, but oftentimes a person is going through drug withdrawals and they're just not physically healthy enough to go to court. Sure. However, perhaps Alan Jackson's looking at this and saying, hey, my client was not mentally fit enough to go to court, not once, mm-hmm. but twice. And they got him in the suicide vest here. And then when you add on a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, well, you've sort of built up the precursors to that. And you can use that later on to the jury, or at least try to, by saying, hey, he couldn't even make his first two court appearances because he was so mentally disturbed immediately after and contemporaneous with this happened.
How often, I found this interesting. I don't have much experience in seeing people in suicide vests, so maybe you can help answer this for me in a courtroom. How often is it that they don't appear to have a shirt on underneath the suicide vest? Is that normal? Because, I mean, to me, it was kind of like, oh, that's your top today.
Yeah, you know, sadly, I've seen a lot of different presentations of folks who are purportedly experiencing issues like that. And sometimes it's even more unnatural looking. Sometimes they have like a spit guard over their face. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they are shackled and bound so they don't try to injure somebody else. But certainly when you look at that photo, you know, if your defense, you're like, that guy looks kind of crazy. That might be part of the defense and part of the presentation to the world.
That's, I guess, part of my question. Who makes the call? Who makes the call of putting him in the suicide vest? Who makes the call of how he's going to look in court? I mean, I know they didn't want him on camera. According to Alan Jackson, the you know, you didn't want it, that version of him shown. So he was kind of behind some glass. It was very difficult to see him other than from the stenographer or the court artist's renderings there. But who makes the call? Is Alan Jackson making the call, going, my client needs to be in a suicide vest, let's get him on him? Or who's making the choice here for this portion of the show?
Usually it's the jail deputies who make that ultimate decision. However, you know, and I'm not saying Alan Jackson did this at all, but just thinking about possibilities, you know, if they weren't going to have it, if they were just going to have him in regular jail garb and they got a call from the defense attorney saying, hey, look, this guy might kill himself or he might hurt somebody else. You will need to take precautionary measures to make sure that doesn't happen. Well, that might persuade the jail in an abundance of caution to cover their own ass by putting him in this kind of garb, which might just lo and behold support sort of the narrative defense may intend to present.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that all this might not be completely necessary. It probably likely is very necessary. I'm just looking at this from the perspective of Alan Jackson is a very good strategic attorney, and if he's going to play a card, he's going to play it well. So I'm just kind of looking at all this of how much is theatrics, how much is literally this is the cards that he's been dealt with, you know, from what we know about Nick here in this case, Nick Reiner. He has a documented history of severe drug addiction, including meth and heroin and past psychotic episodes while using. How might the defense use that history to argue diminished capacity or lack of premeditation? How well does that all play into insanity? And especially in California here, you know, what are the prerequisites here? Is it a high bar to reach the insanity defense in California? Some states don't even have it. Do you know what it's going to be like out there in California for them?
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. And as C Legal Canada indicated in one of the comments, you know, you can't just take a bunch of drugs and commit a crime and get off scot-free. That's not how it works. However, there are ways that such a history can contribute to certain defenses, including not guilty by reason of insanity, which usually requires a mental disease or defect that causes a person to not know right from wrong in the moment. So, you know, was there some sort of drug psychosis that kicked in? After years of substance abuse, was there some sort of mental condition that was developed, like schizophrenia or some extreme paranoia, those kinds of things? And so while it's not a defense in and of itself, I imagine it's going to be used towards trying to get Nick off or at least mitigate the possible circumstances. Still a very high bar to show he didn't know right from wrong in the moment. And it can't be only drugs that, caused him to get there. It's got to be a culmination of mental health and other histories, trauma, things like that.
Going back to something that Tony had said about being high profile and things like that, I imagine Alan Jackson's got to ride a very fine line here. He can't villainize the parents and turn this into, you know, whatever happened at that party escalated the situation. Rob Reiner is a beloved figure in our world. I mean, I'm hearing people talk about Princess Bride and Sleepless in Seattle. And I mean, just over and over talking about just what a beloved figure he is. So he's going to have to ride this really careful line and make it appear that Nick is the one who had the problem, that it wasn't the parents who contributed to this, don't you think?
I'm right there with you, Stacey. You know, Rob Reiner and his wife are very sympathetic victims. It's not like they're, it's not like the accusations against the Menendez brothers' parents, at least not yet. We don't know. We don't know what the accusations against the parents might be. So I guess we'll have to see. But you've got to be kind of delicate in terms of blaming the victim or appearing to do so. I think placing the emphasis on Nick's personal challenges, at least for the time being, is the right avenue.
Let's talk about that for a second, because that has run through my mind. I'm curious. I've seen other people speculate. What roads could possibly be gone down by the defense? A lot of us, we're looking, okay, is he insane? Is it the drugs? Or are they going to go down some road of, again, and we have no evidence of anything of this sort, and I feel like it might be pulled out of thin air if it is. Abuse.
Right.
Or this, or that, or whatever bizarro allegation that could completely stain the legacy and the story of Rob Reiner and his storied career without very much of a foundational basis. I guess my question is, how much of a foundational basis would have to be met to go down some of those roads if they were to say, well, he was abused at this age and this happened and that happened and they did this and they did that. I'm not saying they're going to, but they're dead. So they can't really stand up for themselves. They have the other siblings who could be like, that's bullshit.
Yep.
How much do you have to prove before you go down a road of utter insanity? I mean, look at the Karen Reed case. This theory is that these cops beat him up in the house. There's no evidence of it. And I'm not going to Karen Reed's guilt or innocence. I'm just saying it was a story made out of thin air, and it was able to be argued in court, and it influenced a jury. Who's to say they couldn't say Chloe the dog was involved too in this? I mean, it's just, where is the bar here? And what, again, what where do they have to reach before they can start pulling shit out of their ass and saying this is real?
Sure. And let me just say, all the information I've reviewed indicates that the Reiners were great parents and tried to help this kid.
I
don't personally know. But, when a life in prison is on the line or possibly the death penalty, people are going to look at every possible out they can. Here, what that would require, it's essentially a self-defense claim. Like in the Menendez brothers case, they're kind of saying the abuse happened happened frequently over time. It had such a cumulative effect that the child was scared that it would continue happening, and he felt that he had to do this in order to stop that from happening. In terms of the threshold to meet, defense doesn't have to meet a high threshold. It's really just some colorable evidence that is supporting such a claim. And then when that happens in most jurisdictions, the burden shifts to the prosecution to disprove it. And so how in the world would if such an allegation arose, how in the world would the prosecution disprove it? Like you said, they could call the other siblings to say, hey, that's BS. But gosh, if you have one sibling who is just saying, hey, this happened behind closed doors, there's no photos of it, that's not how these things go down, that's a hard thing to disprove.
That's what I'm worried about.
Makes my stomach turn even thinking that could come out.
Well, and look, and if there, that's what I'm wondering about is that bar there is, yeah, is what he just has to basically come out of Nick's mouth and then somehow it's fact and can be argued as fact. That's kind of scary that there doesn't have to be any sort of real evidence supporting an accusation like that. And look, and if there were to be an accusation and there is evidence of something, and again, there's no evidence pointing to any, this is just pure, pure speculation of thinking, where could they go with this? If there is some sort of evidence for anyone doing anything horrible, yes, that should be exposed. You know, your history be damned if there is anything there. But if there's not, the fact that a known addict, manipulator, liar, piece of shit could just basically say something like that out loud, and then it could be run with in court. It's kind of a scary proposition.
Yeah, no, it's troubling to think about. And, you know, it's in part a function of our Constitution and how our court system's set up. And what I mean is that the defense doesn't have a burden at trial. They didn't have to come up with some prior allegation of abuse and prove that to a jury. It's not their job. It's the prosecution's job to prove guilt and typically to disprove affirmative defenses like self-defense. And so, yeah, courts usually require a little something more than just the defendant saying it. They might require some kind of corroborative thing. Did the defendant ever text anybody about this, email somebody about it? In the Menendez case, there was this alleged letter that one of the Menendez brothers sent to a cousin purporting to reference this abuse. Typically, it's like a statement plus, but not always. And still, that plus is a pretty small plus.
Well, and here's the other interesting part to think about when you're dealing with an addict. They're going to lie, and I'm sure he has a history and a documented history of lying, cheating, saying whatever the hell he needs to say to someone to manipulate them to get his way. Yeah. So it's not a crazy bridge that far to think that maybe somewhere along the line of the last 20 years, he's made a claim like that to somebody to get sympathy, to get empathy. When his parents had said, good luck, there's nothing more we can do for you. People make shit up. That, I don't know. I'm concerned in that area. Not because I think the Reiners did anything like that. I do not believe that Rob Reiner or his wife or that family were anything of that ilk. In fact, just quite the opposite. But when you get really vile people involved in something like this, really vile things can take place. Who knows? I'm just talking about that road for a moment because I don't think anybody's really gone down it yet. If we're talking about a drug-induced psychosis here, because you have two different types. You have someone who is a psychopath, someone where it's just in them, it's not going away. Then you have something where it's induced, something where this is, you know, either part of a mental illness or something that's induced from a substance. How far down the insanity road does that play? Is that a strong argument? If it's a drug-induced psychosis, this made him do it. Had he been in his right mind, he wouldn't have done it. Couldn't the prosecution argue back? Yes, and you chose to do those drugs, and you know you have a history of this, of being psychotic or having drug-induced psychosis episodes. So you made that choice. You pulled the trigger on yourself, basically, by taking those drugs, and this is the consequences of your actions, whether you remember them or not.
Sure. What we're touching on is the fact that as a general rule, voluntary intoxication is not a defense. Like I said, you can't just take a bunch of drugs, commit a bunch of crimes, and then get off scot-free. It's not how it works. However, if there has been, you know, years, if not decades of methamphetamine abuse, for example, that can change a person's brain. That can give rise to or influence or contribute to a mental disease or defect that is diagnosable and that can, I guess in theory, might serve as some kind of part of an insanity defense. It couldn't be that he just did a bunch of drugs that day and freaked out. Like, that's not going to be a defense. But if he abused meth over the course of years and developed this like severe paranoia such that he is detached from reality, whether he's using drugs or not, and then this thing happened, that could be a mental disease or defect that could impair a person's ability to know right from wrong, or at least the defense might style it like that.
Well, it looks like an institutional failure. He's been in 17 times and they couldn't fix him. So what, you know, what could be done? I mean, it looks like they've got a lot of boxes checked for this insanity plea, if that's the road they go down.
Sure. And I mean, if your defense, I think you're looking at that and saying, hey, for how long has this young man been troubled? For how long has he been afflicted by these issues? Look at how horrible it's rendered his life. You know, he's the son of this famous movie director, and he was homeless at times. Like, you better believe that this contributed to his mental state. I'm just saying what defense is saying. That's not my personal opinion. But there are certainly arguments that will be made based on the history of Nick and what he has dealt with and what some people might say what he's done to himself.
I want to talk about, you mentioned institutional failure, Stacey, and I don't think it's institutional failure. It's the failure of the addict to accept any sort of treatment at the end of the day. You can have, and this is a prime example of it. They've tried some of the best, all of them, anything they possibly could, and he would not get with the program. At the end of the day, it is up to the addicts to get with the program, to make the choices that they need in their life to get better. The institution can only go so far and do so much. Is that something that can be argued in court as well if they try to go down that road?
I'm not sure how much traction they would get on something like that because, you know, we all have institutions that fail us, some folks more than others. And you know, that's not something that I can go to a jury and be like, hey, this guy got a bunch of crummy breaks, man. So find him not guilty of stabbing his parents.
Yeah.
Like there's just a disconnect there. And I think that juries looking at it might say, screw that, man. We all have to deal with shit.
Sure. If the prosecution does pursue the death penalty, what sort of mitigating factors would you expect the defense to present during the actual penalty phase of this? And how effective are addiction and mental health histories in California capital cases in terms of getting somebody off of death row or never getting on it in the first place?
You know, the substance abuse road in terms of mitigation, a death penalty can be a double-edged sword because, you know, some folks might be judgmental about that, or they might not be judgmental, but they might say, hey, you did that to yourself, man. Mm-hmm. That's not something that makes you less morally culpable here. On the other hand, I think they're likely going to be mitigating factors. You know, one is age. Nick was not, you know, he was a rather young man. I don't know about his criminal history. I know he's had a history with drug use. But if he hasn't been convicted, if he hasn't racked up a bunch of convictions, a lack of criminal history can be a mitigating factor. Mm-hmm. If, and I'm just completely speculating, but if there was some kind of prior trauma or mistreatment by the decedents, that could be something that is brought up. The fact that he didn't kill any children or more than two people, sometimes they really get down to the nitty gritty in terms of this could have been a lot worse.
He only killed two people. He was at a party with a bunch of celebrities and could have gone batshit crazy is probably Jesus. What you're thinking, right?
Potentially. I mean, a hard argument to make, maybe not one I'd make, but I'm just saying they might say, hey, you look at the Aurora Theater shooting, that guy killed 10 plus people. He didn't get the death penalty. Don't give this guy the death penalty.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like at least I'm not that bad, quite type of argument. Nick Reiner's arraignment now pushed to January 7th. What do you think the defense is doing right now behind the scenes to prepare? And what's the first major battle that they're going to have to fight here come the 7th?
Sure. So I think that they are likely having their mental health experts evaluate Nick. I think they are pulling all historical medical and rehab records to review anything in his past that could have explained what happened or could be a part of an insanity defense. On top of that, you know, they got to prove that Nick did this, and they got to prove what happened in there. I saw C Legal Canada mention it's likely not an accident, and that very well could be. But you got to prove it's not an accident. You got to prove it wasn't self-defense. Now, those things might seem far-fetched, but when we're talking about death penalty litigation, they're going to leave no stone unturned. And the prosecution's got to prove up those facts. And when you only have one out of three of the people alive still who know what happened in that house, that can be harder than you think.
It's going to be fascinating. So many questions, so many unanswered questions in this, and time is really what is going to tell what takes place next here. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight onto this case. You guys let us know what you think in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and press subscribe while you're at it so you don't miss any of our coverage. We're going to keep following this all the way through. Until next time, for Eric, for Todd, for Stacy, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget, so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap. Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.